springs, Marya Vlasyevna bent those little arms which stuck up and encased them in linen garments. He was so filled with pity for that being, and so alarmed lest she should hurt it, that he tried to restrain her hand. Marya Vlasyevna laughed. "Don't be afraid! Don't be afraid!" When the baby had been swaddled and made into a firm doll, Marya Vlasyevna turned it over as if proud of her work, and stepped aside that Levin might see his son in all his beauty. Kitty turned her eyes and gazed fixedly in the same direction. "Let me have him, let me have him," she said, and was even going to raise herself.
"What are you doing, Katerina Alexandrovna? You must not move like that. Wait a moment, I'll give him to you. Let's show Papa what a fine fellow we are."
And Marya Vlasyevna held out to Levin on one hand, the other merely supporting the nape of the shaky head, this strange, limp, red creature that hid its head in its swaddling clothes. But there was also a nose, blinking eyes, and smacking lips.
"A beautiful baby," said Marya Vlasyevna.
Levin sighed bitterly. This beautiful baby only inspired him with a sense of repulsion and pity. These were not at all the feelings he had expected. He turned away while Marya Vlasyevna laid the child to the unaccustomed breast. Suddenly a laugh made him lift his head. It was Kitty laughing. The baby had taken the breast.
"Well, that's enough, that's enough," said Marya Vlasyevna,
but Kitty would not part with the baby. He fell asleep in her arms.
"Now look at him,"
said Kitty, turning him so that Levin could see him. The odd-looking little face wrinkled up still more, and the baby sneezed. Smiling, and hardly able to keep back tears of tenderness, Levin kissed his wife and quitted the darkened room. What he felt toward this little creature was not at all what he had anticipated. There was nothing merry or joyful in it. On the contrary, there was a new and distressing sense of fear. It was the consciousness of another vulnerable region. And this consciousness was at first so painful, the fear lest that helpless being should suffer was so strong, that it quite hid the strange feeling of unreasoning joy and even pride which he experienced when the baby sneezed. Chapter 17. Oblonsky's affairs were in a bad state. Two-thirds of the money for the forest had already been spent, and by allowing a discount of 10%, he had obtained from the merchant almost the whole of the last third. But the latter would not advance any more of the money, especially as Dolly, who had that winter for the first time plainly claimed a right to her own property, had refused to endorse the contract with a receipt for the last third of the payment. Oblonsky's whole salary went for household expenses and the liquidation of small, pressing bills. He had no money at all. This was unpleasant, inconvenient, and in Oblonsky's opinion ought not to continue. The cause, as he understood it, was that he received too small a salary. The position had certainly been a very good one a few years ago, but it was so no longer. Petrov, the bank director, got 12,000 rubles. Sventitsky, director of a company, got 17,000 rubles, and Mitin, having founded a bank, got 50,000 rubles. "Evidently I have been asleep and have been forgotten," thought Oblonsky. And he began pricking up his ears and looking around, and by the end of the winter he had discovered a very good post and begun an attack on it, first from Moscow through aunts, uncles, and friends, and then in the spring, when the matter had ripened, he himself went to Petersburg. This post was one of those, now far more numerous than formerly, carrying salaries from 1,000 to 50,000 rubles a year, soft, profitable jobs. It was a membership of the committee of the joint agency of the mutual credit balance of southern railways and banking houses. Like all such posts, it required such immense knowledge and activity as could hardly be united in one man. And as there was no one found who united those qualities, It was at any rate better for the post to be filled by an honest rather than a dishonest man. Oblonsky was not only an honest man, placing no special emphasis on the word, but he was an honest man with an emphasis, in the special sense attaching to the word in Moscow, where they say, an honest worker, an honest writer, an honest journalist, an honest institution, an honest tendency, meaning not only that the man or the institution are not dishonest, but also that they are capable on occasion of being objectionable to the government. Oblonsky moved in those Moscow circles where that word was used, and was there considered an honest man, so that he had a better claim to the post than other people. The post carried a salary of from 7 to 10,000 rubles a year, and Oblonsky could hold it without resigning his official position. It depended on 2 ministers, 1 lady, and 2 Jews. And though they had already been prepared, it was necessary for Oblonsky to see all these people in Petersburg. Moreover, he had promised his sister Anna to obtain a decisive answer about the divorce from Karenin. So, having got 50 rubles from Dolly, he went to Petersburg. Sitting in Karenin's study and listening to his article on the causes of the bad state of Russian finance, Oblonsky only waited for him to conclude to speak about his own affairs and about Anna. "Yes, it is very true," Oblonsky agreed, when Karenin, taking off the pince-nez without which he could no longer read, looked up inquiringly at his former brother-in-law. "It is very true in detail, but all the same the principle of today is freedom."
"Yes, but I bring forward another principle which embraces the principle of freedom," said Karenin, accentuating the word "embraces," and putting his pince-nez on again to re-read the part where this was said. Turning over the beautifully written, very broad-margined manuscript, Karenin re-read the convincing passage. "I do not want protection for the benefit of private individuals, but for the common good, for the lowest and for the highest classes equally," he said, looking at Oblonsky over his pince-nez. "But they cannot understand this. They are concerned only with their private interests and are carried away by phrases." Oblonsky knew that when Karenin began talking about what they did and thought, they being those who did not wish to accept his projects and were the cause of all the evil in Russia, the end of the subject was near at hand, and he therefore willingly abandoned the principle of freedom and agreed entirely. Karenin was silent, thoughtfully turning over the leaves of his manuscript.
"Oh, by the way," said Oblonsky, "I wanted to ask you to take an opportunity when you see Pomorsky to put in a word for me, and to tell him that I should very much like to get the vacant post of member of the committee of the joint agency of the mutual credit balance of Southern Railways."
The name of the post that was so near his heart was already familiar to Oblonsky, and he pronounced it rapidly without any blunder. Karenin inquired what was the work of this new committee, and pondered. He was considering whether in the activity of this committee there was not something at variance with his own projects. But as the work of the new institution was very complicated and his project covered a very extensive domain, he could not decide this immediately, and taking off his pince-nez said, "Certainly I could speak to him, but really, why do you want the post?"
"The salary is good, up to 9,000, and my means..."
9,000? Repeated Karenin, and frowned. The large figure of the salary reminded him that, in that respect, the post Oblonsky was aspiring to was opposed to the main idea of his projects, which always tended toward economy. "I consider, and I have written an article on the point, that the enormous salaries paid nowadays are a symptom of the false economic position of our administration."
"Yes, but what would you have?" said Oblonsky. "Let's say a bank director gets 10,000. He's worth it, you know. Or an engineer gets 20,000. It's a live business, anyway."
"I consider that a salary is payment for value received and should be subject to the law of supply and demand. If that law is ignored when fixing a salary, as, for instance, when I see that of 2 engineers who have passed through the same institute and are equally well-instructed and capable, one receives 40,000 and the other is satisfied with 2,000, or when lawyers or hussars who have no special knowledge are appointed directors of banks or companies and receive,
gigantic salaries, I conclude that these salaries are not fixed by the law of supply and demand, but by personal influence. This is an abuse, important in itself, which has a bad effect on the state service. I consider... Oblonsky hastened to interrupt his brother-in-law.
Yes, said he, but you will agree that a new and unquestionably useful institution is being started. Anyway, it is a live business. It is particularly desired that the work should be managed honestly, concluded Oblonsky, with an emphasis on the word.
But the Moscow meaning of honest was unintelligible to Karenin. Honesty is only a negative quality, said he.
But you would greatly oblige me all the same if you would put in a word, when you happen to see Pomorsky, said Oblonsky.
But it depends chiefly on Bolgarinov, I think, said Karenin.
Bolgarinov quite agrees as far as he is concerned, returned Oblonsky, with a blush.
He blushed at the mention of Bolgarinov, because he had that morning been to see the Jew, and the visit had left an unpleasant impression on his mind. Oblonsky was firmly convinced that the business he wished to serve was new, alive, and honest. But that morning, when Bolgarinov, with obvious intention, made him wait 2 hours in his waiting room with other petitioners, he had suddenly felt uncomfortable. Whether it was that he, Prince Oblonsky, a descendant of Rurik, was waiting 2 hours in a Jew's waiting room, or that, for the first time in his life, he was departing from the example set by his ancestors of serving the state only and was entering on a new field, at any rate he felt uncomfortable. During those 2 hours in Bolgarinov's waiting room, he had walked about, boldly, smoothing his whiskers, entering into conversation with other applicants, inventing a joke to tell of how he had waited at the Jews, carefully concealing his feelings from others and even from himself. But all the time he felt uncomfortable and vexed, without knowing why. Was it that nothing would come of his pun, "I had business with a Jew, but could not get at him even to say adieu, adieu," or was it something else? And when Bolgarinov at length received him with extreme politeness, evidently triumphing in his humiliation, and very nearly refused his request, Oblonsky hastened to forget it as quickly as he could, and only now, on recollecting it, blushed.
Chapter 18. Now, there's another matter. You know what it is? About Anna, said Oblonsky, after a short pause when he had shaken off the unpleasant recollection.
Directly Oblonsky mentioned Anna's name, Karenin's face entirely changed. Instead of its former animation, it expressed weariness and lifelessness. "What is it you wish of me?" Karenin said, turning round in his chair and folding his pince-nez.
"A decision. Some decision, Alexei Alexandrovich. I address myself to you not as..."
He was going to say, as an offended husband, but afraid of injuring his case thereby, he changed the expression to, not as a statesman, this sounded inappropriate, but simply as a man, a kind man and a Christian.
You should have pity on her.
What do you mean exactly? Asked Karenin in a low tone.
Why, pity her. If you had seen her as I have, who have spent the whole winter with her, you would pity her. Her position is awful, literally awful.
It seems to me, returned Karenin in a more high-pitched, almost squeaky voice, that Anna Arkadyevna has everything she herself desired.
Oh, Alexei Alexandrovich, for God's sake, don't let us have any recriminations. What is past is past. You know what she wants and is waiting for, the divorce.
But I understood that Anna Arkadyevna declined a divorce if I insisted on keeping my son. I answered in that sense and thought the matter was closed. I consider it closed, shrieked Karenin.
For heaven's sake, don't excite yourself, said Oblonsky, touching his brother-in-law's knee. The matter is not closed. If you will let me recapitulate, this is how matters stood. When you parted, you were great, as magnanimous as a man can possibly be. You consented to everything,
her freedom and even a divorce. She appreciated that. Yes, don't think otherwise. She really appreciated it. She appreciated it to such a degree that, at the moment, feeling herself to blame toward you, she did not consider and could not consider everything. She renounced everything. But facts and time have shown that her situation is tormenting and impossible. Anna Arkadyevna's life cannot interest me, interposed Karenin, lifting his brows. Allow me not to believe that, Oblonsky rejoined gently. Her situation is tormenting to her and does not benefit anyone. She has deserved it, you may say. She knows that and does not ask you for anything. She says plainly that she dare not ask anything. But I, and all her relatives who all love her, beg and implore you. Why should she be so tormented? Who gains by it?
Excuse me, you seem to be placing me in the position of defendant, Karenin remonstrated.
Oh, no, no, not at all. Understand me, said Oblonsky, now touching Karenin's hand, as if he was sure that the contact would soften his brother-in-law. All I say is that her position is tormenting and could be made easier by you without any detriment to yourself. I would arrange everything for you so that you would not be bothered. You see, you promised.
The promise was given before, and I thought the question about my son had settled the matter. Besides, I hoped that Anna Arkadyevna would have generosity enough,
uttered Karenin with difficulty, his lips trembling and his face turning pale.
She leaves everything to your generosity. She asks, she pleads for one thing only. Help her out of the intolerable position she is in. She no longer asks for her son.
Alexei Alexandrovich, you are a good man. Enter for a moment into her situation. The question of a divorce is for her, in her position, one of life and death. If you had not promised before, she would have grown reconciled to her position and have gone on living in the country. But as you had promised, she wrote to you and moved to Moscow, and now in Moscow, where every time she meets anyone it is like a knife in her heart, she has been living for 6 months every day expecting your decision. Why, it's like keeping a man condemned to death with the halter round his neck for months, promising him either death or a reprieve. Have pity on her, and I undertake to arrange. Your scruples...
I am not speaking of that.
That, Karenin interrupted him in a disgusted tone. But perhaps I promised something I had no right to promise.
Then you refuse what you promised?
I have never refused to do what is possible. But I want time to consider in how far what was promised is possible.
No, Alexei Alexandrovich, said Oblonsky, jumping to his feet. I will not believe that. She is as wretched as a woman can be, and you cannot refuse such a...
As far as what I promised is possible. Vous professez d'être un libre penseur, but I, as a believer, in so important a matter, cannot act contrary to the Christian law. But in Christian communities, and in ours too, as far as I know, divorce is permitted, said Oblonsky. Divorce is also permitted by our church. And we see...
It is permitted, but not in that sense.
Alexei Alexandrovich, I don't recognize you, said Oblonsky after a pause. Was it not you, and did we not appreciate it, who forgave everything and, moved just by Christian feeling, were ready to sacrifice everything? You yourself said, give your coat when they would take your cloak. And now,
I beg, began Karenin in a shrill voice, suddenly rising to his feet, pale and with trembling jaw,
I beg you to stop this conversation.
Oh, no. Well, then, Forgive me. Forgive me if I have pained you, said Oblonsky with an embarrassed smile, holding out his hand. I only delivered my message as an envoy.
Karenin gave him his hand, reflected, and then said,
I must think it over and seek for guidance. The day after tomorrow, I will give you a final answer, he added, after consideration.
Chapter 19. Oblonsky was just leaving when Korney entered and announced, Sergei Alexeyevich. Who is Sergei Alexeyevich? Oblonsky was about to ask, but immediately recollected. Oh, Seretse, he said. Sergei Alexeyevich. Why, I thought it was the director of the department. And he remembered that Anna had asked him to see the boy. He recalled the timid, pathetic look with which Anna, at parting from him, had said, Anyhow, you will see him. Find out everything. Where he is, who is with him. And, Stiva, if it is possible... Isn't it possible? He had understood what, if it is possible, meant. It meant, if it is possible to arrange the divorce so that she should have her son. But now Oblonsky saw that it was useless even to think of that. He was, however, glad to see his nephew. Karenin reminded his brother-in-law that they never mentioned his mother to the boy and asked him not to say a word about her. He was very ill after that unexpected interview with his mother, remarked Karenin. We even feared for his life. But sensible treatment and sea-bathing in the summer have restored his health, and now, on doctor's advice, I send him to school. The influence of his schoolfellows has really had a good effect on him, and he is quite well and learns well.
Hello! What a fine fellow! True enough, it's not little Seretse now, but a complete Sergei Alexeyevich, said Oblonsky, smiling as he looked at a handsome boy in a blue jacket and long trousers who entered the room boldly and confidently. The lad looked healthy and bright. He bowed to his uncle as to a stranger, but recognizing him, he blushed and turned away from him quickly, as if offended and angry about something. The boy came up to his father and handed him his school report.
Well, that's pretty good, said his father. You may go now.
He has grown thin and tall, and is no longer a child but a regular boy, said Oblonsky. I like it. Do you remember me?
The boy glanced swiftly at his father. I do, mon oncle, he answered, looking at his uncle and then again lowering his eyes. His uncle called him nearer and took his hand.
Well, how are things?
Said he, wishing to start a conversation, but not knowing what to say. The boy, blushing and not answering, gently withdrew his hand from his uncle's grasp. As soon as Oblonsky released it, after a questioning glance at his father, he hastily left the room like a bird let out of its cage. A year had passed since Seretse last saw his mother. Since then he had not heard any more of her. During this year he had been sent to school and had learnt to know his schoolmates and to like them. The dreams and memories of his mother, which, after their interview, had made him ill, no longer occupied him. When they rose in his memory, he took pains to drive them away, considering them shameful and fit only for girls, but not for a boy and a chum. He knew that his father and mother had had a quarrel which separated them, knew that it was his fate to remain with his father, and he tried to accustom himself to that thought. He felt uncomfortable at meeting his uncle, who resembled his mother, because it awakened those very memories which he considered shameful. It was the more disagreeable because from some words he had overheard while waiting outside the study door, and especially from his father's and uncle's faces, he guessed that they had been talking about his mother. And in order not to blame the father with whom he lived and upon whom he depended, and above all not to give way to the sensibility which he considered so degrading, Seretse tried not to look at that uncle, who had come to upset his peace of mind, and not to think of what was called to mind by the sight of him.
But when Oblonsky, who had come out after him, saw him on the stairs, and called him and asked how he spent his time between lessons at school, Seretse, in his father's absence, got into conversation with him. "We play at railways now," he said, answering the question. "You see, it's this way. Two sit down on a form, they are passengers. One stands on the same form. The others all harness themselves to it. They may do it with their hands or their belts. And then off they go through all the rooms. The doors are opened beforehand. It's not easy to be the guard."
"That's the one who stands up?" asked Oblonsky with a smile.
"Yes, it needs courage and quickness, especially if they stop suddenly or if somebody falls down."
"Yes, that's no joke," said Oblonsky, looking sadly into those animated eyes so like the mother's, an infant's eyes no longer, and no longer altogether innocent.
And, in spite of his promise to Karenin, he could not refrain from speaking of Anna.
"Do you remember your mother?" he suddenly asked.
"No, I don't," hurriedly replied Seretse, and blushing scarlet he hung down his head. His uncle could get nothing more out of him. Half an hour later the Slav tutor found his pupil on the stairs, and for a long while could not make out whether he was in a temper or was simply crying.
"I expect you hurt yourself when you fell down?" said the tutor. "I told you it was a dangerous game. I shall have to tell your headmaster about it."
"If I hadn't hurt myself, no one would have known it. That is quite certain."
"Well, then, what is it?"
"Leave me alone. If I do remember, or if I don't. What business is it of his? Why should I remember? Leave me alone,"
he said, now addressing not his tutor, but the world in general. Chapter 20. As was his wont, Oblonsky did not spend his time idly while in Petersburg. Besides business, his sister's divorce and his post, it was as usual necessary for him, as he said, to refresh himself in Petersburg after the mustiness of Moscow. Moscow, despite its café chantant and its omnibuses, was still a stagnant pool. Oblonsky always felt this. After living in Moscow, especially in the bosom of his family, Oblonsky always felt his spirits flag. When he had spent a long time in Moscow without a break, he reached a state in which he began to be upset by his wife's ill-humour and reproaches, by the health and education of the children, and the petty details of his work. Even the fact that he was in debt worried him then. But he only needed to spend some time in Petersburg, among the set in which he moved, where people lived, really lived, instead of vegetating as in Moscow, and at once all these cares vanished and melted away like wax before a fire. His wife? Only that day he had been talking to Prince Chechensky. He had a wife and family with grown-up sons who were pages at court, and another family, an illegitimate one, in which there were other children. Though the first family was all right, Prince Chechensky felt happier with the second family. He took his eldest son to visit the second family and told Oblonsky that he considered it developed his son and was good for him. What would they say to that in Moscow? Children? In Petersburg, children did not hinder their father's living. Children were brought up in educational establishments, and there were none of those barbaric views that were becoming so prevalent in Moscow. Lyovov's was a case in point, that the children should have every luxury and the parents nothing but work and worry. Here people understood that a man must live his own life like a civilized being. The service. Service, too, was not here that strained, hopeless drudgery that it was in Moscow. Here there was an interest in the service. Meeting the right person, a service rendered, a felicitous remark, the ability to perform certain tricks, made a man's career in a moment, as was the case with Bryantsov, whom Oblonsky had met the day before, and who was now a great dignitary. Service of that kind had an interest.
but it was the Petersburg outlook on money matters that had a particularly soothing effect on Oblonsky. Bartnyansky, who spent at least 50,000 rubles a year at the rate he was living, had the day before made a notable remark to him on the point. As they were having a chat before dinner, Oblonsky had said to Bartnyansky, "You are, I think, intimate with Modvinsky. You could do me a good turn if you would put in a word for me. There is a post I should like to get. Member of the agency—" "Never mind the name, I shouldn't remember it. But why do you want to mix in those railway concerns with Jews? Look at it how you like, it's horrid." Oblonsky did not tell him that it was a live business. Bartnyansky would not have understood that. "I am hard up, have nothing to live on."
"But you do live?"
"Yes, but in debt."
"Really? Is it much?"
asked Bartnyansky sympathetically.
"Very much. About 20,000 rubles.
Bartnyansky burst into merry laughter.
"Oh, you lucky fellow," he cried. "My debts amount to 1.5 million, and I have nothing. But, as you see, I still find it possible to live."
Oblonsky knew this to be true, not only from hearsay, but from actual fact. Zviarkov, whose debts amounted to 300,000 rubles, didn't possess a penny, and yet he lived, and how he lived. Count Krivtsov, whose case had long been considered hopeless, still kept two mistresses. Petrovsky had run through 5 millions, continued living in just the same style, and even directed the finance department and received a salary of 20,000. But apart from that, Petersburg acted pleasantly on Oblonsky physically. It made him younger. In Moscow, he sometimes noticed some grey hairs, fell asleep after dinner, stretched himself, walked slowly upstairs, breathing heavily, felt dull among young women, and did not dance at balls. In Petersburg, he always felt that he had shaken off 10 years. In Petersburg, he felt what the 60-year-old Prince Pyotr Oblonsky, who had just returned from abroad, had described to him only the day before.
"Here, we don't know how to live," Pyotr Oblonsky had said. "Would you believe it, I spent the summer in Baden and really felt quite like a young man. I see a young woman, and my fancy, I dine, drink a little, and feel strong and full of spirits. I returned to Russia and had to be with my wife, and in the country besides, and in a fortnight I took to a dressing gown and gave up dressing for dinner. And as to thinking about young women, why, I had turned into quite an old man. There was nothing left for me but to think of saving my soul. Then I went to Paris and again recovered."
Stepan experienced just the same difference as Pyotr Oblonsky. In Moscow, he let himself go to such an extent that, had he continued to live there long, he might even have come to the soul-saving stage. But in Petersburg, he again felt quite a smart fellow. Between the Princess Betsy Tverskaya and Oblonsky, there existed long-established and very peculiar relations. Oblonsky, in fun, always paid court to her and told her the most indecent things, also in fun, knowing that she liked that more than anything. The day after his interview with Karenin, Oblonsky, calling on her, felt so youthful that he went accidentally to such lengths in this bantering courtship and humbug that he did not know how to get out of it, for unfortunately she was not merely unattractive, but actually repulsive to him. This tone had sprung up between them because he was very attractive to her. So he had been very pleased when the Princess Mayakaya turned up and put an end to their tête-à-tête.
"Ah, so you are here," she said on seeing him. "Well, how is your poor sister? Don't look at me like that," she added. "Since everyone has been attacking her, all those who are 100,000 times worse than she, I have thought she has acted splendidly."
"I can't forgive Vronsky for not letting me know when she was in Petersburg. I would have gone to her and with her everywhere. Please, give her my love."
"Well, tell me about her."
"Yes, her situation is a hard one," Oblonsky began, in the simplicity of his heart, taking the Princess Mayakaya's words for genuine coin when she said, "Tell me about her." But the Princess Mayakaya immediately interrupted him, as was her habit, and commenced telling her own tale.
She has done what everybody, except myself, does secretly, and she would not deceive, and has acted splendidly. And the best thing she did was to leave that half-witted brother-in-law of yours. Excuse me. Everyone used to say, he is so clever, so clever. I alone said that he was stupid. Now that he has got so chummy with Lydia Ivanovna and Landau, everyone says he is half-witted. And I should be glad not to agree with everybody, but this time I can't help it.
But do explain to me what it means, said Oblonsky.
Yesterday I called on him about my sister's affair and asked him for a definite answer. He did not give me an answer, but said he must think it over. And this morning, instead of an answer, I have received an invitation for this evening to go to the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's.
Ah, that's it! That's it!
Princess Myakaya began joyfully. They will ask Landau and see what he says.
Ask Landau?
Why?
Who is Landau?
What? You don't know Jules Landau? Le fameux Jules Landau, le clairvoyant?
He also is half-witted. But your sister's fate depends on him. See what comes of living in the provinces. You know nothing.
Landau, you see, was a commis in Paris and went to see a doctor. He fell asleep in the doctor's waiting room and, while asleep, began giving advice to all the patients, and very strange advice, too. Afterwards, Yuri Melodinsky's wife, the invalid's wife, you know, heard of that Landau and took him to see her husband. He is treating her husband. No good has been done, in my opinion, for he is still just as weak, but they believe in him and take him about with them. So they brought him to Russia. Here, everyone rushed at him, and he began treating everybody. He cured the Countess Betsubova, and she took such a fancy to him that she adopted him.
Adopted? How?
Simply adopted him. He is now no longer Landau, but Count Betsubov. However, that's not to the point.
But Lydia, I am very fond of her, but her head is not screwed on right, naturally has rushed at this Landau, and now nothing is settled either by her or by Karenin without him. So your sister's fate is now in the hands of this Landau, alias Count Betsubov.
Chapter 21. After an excellent dinner and a large quantity of brandy at Bartnyansky's, Oblonsky, only a little after the appointed time, entered the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's house.
"Who is with the Countess?
The Frenchman?" Oblonsky asked the hall porter, noticing on the hall stand Karenin's overcoat, which he recognized, and a strange, absurd-looking paletot with clasps.
"Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin and Count Betsubov," the hall porter replied severely.
The Princess Myakaya guessed correctly, thought Oblonsky as he ascended the stairs.
Strange. But it would be just as well to make friends with her. She has tremendous influence. If she would say a word to Pomorsky, the job is done.
It was still quite light out of doors, but in the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's small drawing-room the blinds were down and the lamp alight. At the round table beneath a lamp sat the Countess and Karenin, conversing in low tones. A short, lean man, with hips like a woman's, knock-kneed, very pale, handsome, with beautiful, shining eyes and long hair that hung over the collar of his frock coat, stood at the opposite end of the room, looking at the portraits on the wall. After greeting the hostess and Karenin, Oblonsky involuntarily glanced at the stranger once more.
"Monsieur Landau," the Countess addressed him with a softness and caution that struck Oblonsky, and she introduced them. Landau hurriedly looked round, approached smilingly, laid upon Oblonsky's outstretched hand his own moist and motionless one, went back, and continued looking at the portraits. The Countess and Karenin glanced at each other significantly.
"I am very pleased to see you, especially today," said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, pointing to a seat beside Karenin.
"I introduced him to you as Landau," she said softly, glancing at the Frenchman and then back at Oblonsky.
But really, he is Count Betsubov, as you probably know. But he does not like that title.
Yes, I have heard, replied Oblonsky. They say he has completely cured the Countess Betsubov.
She called on me today and was so pathetic, said the Countess, turning to Karenin. This separation is dreadful for her. It is such a blow to her.
Is he going, definitely? Inquired Karenin.
Yes, he is going to Paris. He heard a voice yesterday, said the Countess, with a look at Oblonsky.
Ah, a voice, Oblonsky remarked, feeling that he must be as careful as possible in this company, where something peculiar occurred, or was supposed to occur, to which he as yet lacked a clue.
After a momentary pause, the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, as if coming to the important point, turned with a subtle smile to Oblonsky. I have known you a long time, and am very pleased to know you more intimately. Les amis de nos amis sont nos amis. But to be a friend, one must enter into the state of the friend's soul, and I fear you will not do so in relation to Alexei Alexandrovich. You understand what I am speaking about? She said, lifting her beautiful, dreamy eyes.
To some extent, Countess. I understand that Alexei Alexandrovich's position, said Oblonsky, not quite grasping what it was all about, and therefore wishing to keep to generalities.
The change is not in his external position, Lydia Ivanovna said severely, as her enamoured eyes followed Karenin, who had risen and joined Landau. His heart is changed. He has been given a new heart, and I fear that you may not have realized fully that change which has been accomplished within him.
Well, broadly speaking, I can picture to myself the change. We have always been friendly, and now, Oblonsky said, answering her look with a tender gaze, while he considered with which of two ministers she was the more closely connected, so as to judge which of them he should ask her to influence on his behalf.
The change that has taken place in him cannot weaken his love for his neighbour. On the contrary, that change must strengthen his love. But I fear you don't understand me. Won't you have some tea? She said, indicating with her eyes the footman who was handing tea round on a tray.
Not quite, Countess. Of course, his misfortune...
Yes, a misfortune which has turned into a great blessing, because his heart became new and is filled with him, she said, glancing at Oblonsky with lovesick eyes.
I think I might ask her to mention me to both, thought he.
Oh, certainly, Countess, he said. But I think such changes are so very intimate that nobody, not even the closest friend, cares to speak about them.
On the contrary, we must speak and so help one another.
Oh, yes, of course, but there are such differences of conviction, and besides, said Oblonsky with a gentle smile,
there cannot be any differences in what concerns the holy truth.
Oh, no, of course not, but...
And becoming embarrassed, Oblonsky stopped short.
He realized that it was a question of religion.
It seems to me he will fall asleep directly, said Karenin in a significant whisper, approaching Lydia Ivanovna.
Oblonsky turned. Landau was sitting by the window, leaning against the arm and back of an easy chair, with his head hanging down. Noticing the looks directed toward him, he smiled a childishly naive smile. Take no notice of him, said Lydia Ivanovna, and with an agile movement she pushed forward a chair for Karenin. I have noticed, she began when a footman entered with a note.
Lydia Ivanovna rapidly read the note and, excusing herself with extreme rapidity, wrote and dispatched the answer and returned to the table.
I have noticed, she continued her interrupted sentence, that Muscovites, men especially, are most indifferent to religion.
Oh, no, Countess. I think Muscovites have the reputation of being the most steadfast believers, replied Oblonsky.
But as far as I know, you, unfortunately, are one of the indifferent, Karenin remarked to him with a weary smile.
How can one be indifferent? Said Lydia Ivanovna.
I am, in this respect, not precisely indifferent, but rather expectant, said Oblonsky, with his most mollifying smile. I do not think that, for me, the time for those questions has yet come.
Karenin and Lydia Ivanovna exchanged looks.
We never know whether our time has come or not, Karenin said sternly. We should not consider whether we are ready or not. Grace is not influenced by human calculations. Sometimes it does not descend on those who seek it, but descends on the unprepared, as on Saul.
No, not yet, I think, said Lydia Ivanovna, who was watching the Frenchman's movements. Landau rose and came up to them.
You will allow me to listen? He asked.
Oh, yes, I did not wish to disturb you, said Lydia, looking tenderly at him. Sit down beside us.
Only one must not shut one's eyes so as to deprive oneself of light, Karenin continued.
Oh, if you only knew the happiness we experience feeling his continual presence in our souls, cried the Countess Lydia Ivanovna with a beatific smile.
But one may sometimes feel incapable of ascending to such heights, remarked Oblonsky, conscious that he was not quite honest in acknowledging the existence of religious heights, yet not venturing to confess his scepticism in the presence of one who, by a single word to Pomorsky, might secure him the desired post.
You mean to say he is prevented by sin? Said Lydia Ivanovna. But that is a false view. Sin does not exist for a believer. Sin has already been atoned for.
Excuse me, she added, glancing at the footman, who entered with another note. She read it and answered by word of mouth.
Tell him tomorrow at the Grand Duchess's.
For those who believe, there is no sin, she went on.
Yes, but faith without works is dead, said Oblonsky, recalling that sentence from the Catechism, and only by a smile maintaining his independence. There it is, from the Epistle of St. James, said Karenin, addressing Lydia Ivanovna in a somewhat reproachful tone. Evidently this was a point they had discussed more than once. How much harm has been done by a false interpretation of that passage? Nothing turns so many from the faith as that interpretation. I have no works, and therefore cannot have faith. Yet it is not so said anywhere. Just the contrary is said.
To labour for God with works to save one's soul by fasting, said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna with fastidious disdain. Those are the barbarous opinions of our monks, yet it is not so said anywhere. It is much simpler and easier, she added, looking at Oblonsky with the same encouraging smile with which at court she encouraged young maids of honour who were confused by their new surroundings.
We are saved by Christ, who suffered for us. We are saved by faith, Karenin chimed in, showing his approval of her remark by a look.
Vous comprenez l'anglais?
Asked Lydia Ivanovna. And having received an affirmative answer, she rose and began looking among the books on a shelf.
I want to read Safe and Happy or Under the Wing, she said with a questioning look at Karenin. And having found the book and sat down again, she opened it. It is quite short. It describes the way to acquire faith and the joy, higher than anything else on earth, with which it fills the soul.
A believer cannot be unhappy because he is not alone. But you will see. She was about to begin reading when the footman came in again.
Borodstina? Say tomorrow at 2.
Yes, she went on, keeping her finger in the book to mark the place, and sighed, looking with her beautiful, dreamy eyes straight before her. This is how true faith acts. You know Maria Sanina? You have heard of her misfortune?
She lost her only child.
She was in despair.
Well?
And what happened? She found this friend. And now she thanks God for her child's death. That is the happiness faith gives.
Oh, yes, it is very... began Oblonsky, glad that she was going to read and give him time to get his ideas together.
No, evidently it will be better not to ask for anything tonight, he reflected. Only let me get away from here without making a mess of things.
It will be dull for you, said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, turning to Landau, as you don't understand English. But it is quite short.
Oh, I shall understand, replied Landau with the same smile, and closed his eyes.
Karenin and Lydia Ivanovna exchanged significant looks, and the reading began. Chapter 22. Oblonsky felt completely puzzled by the strange and novel language he was listening to. Generally, the complications of Petersburg life had an exhilarating effect on him, lifting him out of the Moscow stagnation. But he liked and understood complications in spheres congenial and familiar to him. In these strange surroundings, he felt puzzled and dazed and could not take it all in. Listening to the Countess Lydia Ivanovna and feeling the fine eyes, naive or roguish, he did not know which, of Landau fixed upon him, Oblonsky began to be conscious of a peculiar sort of heaviness in his head. The most varied ideas were mixed up in his mind. Maria Sanina is glad that her child is dead. I should like to have a smoke. To be saved, one need only have faith. The monks don't know how to do it, but the Countess Lydia Ivanovna knows. And what is so heavy in my head? Is it the brandy, or is it because all this is so very strange? All the same, I think I have not done anything to shock them up till now, but still it won't do to ask her help now. I have heard that they make one pray. Supposing they make me pray, that would be too stupid. And what nonsense she is reading, but her enunciation is good. Landau Betsubov. Why is he Betsubov? Suddenly, Oblonsky felt his nether jaw dropping irresistibly for a yawn. He smoothed his whiskers to hide the yawn and gave himself a shake. But then he felt himself falling asleep and nearly snored. He roused himself just when the Countess Lydia Ivanovna uttered the words, "He is asleep." Oblonsky awoke in a fright, feeling guilty and detected. But he was immediately comforted by noticing that the words, "he is asleep," did not apply to him, but to Landau. The Frenchman had fallen asleep just as Oblonsky had done. But whereas Oblonsky's sleep would, he imagined, have offended them, he did not really even think this, for everything seemed so strange, Landau's sleep delighted them extremely, especially Lydia Ivanovna.
"Mon ami,"
said she, carefully holding the folds of her silk dress to prevent its rustling, and in her excitement calling Karenin not Alexei Alexandrovich, but
"mon ami, donnez-lui la main. Vous voyez?"
"Hush," she said to the footman, who came in again. "I am not receiving." The Frenchman slept, or pretended to sleep, leaning his head against the back of the chair, and his moist hand, lying on his knee, moved feebly, as if catching something. Karenin rose, and though he tried to be cautious, he caught against the table. He went up to the Frenchman and placed his hand in his. Oblonsky also rose, and opening his eyes wide to wake himself up in case he was asleep, looked first at one and then at the other. It was all quite real, and Oblonsky felt his head getting worse and worse.
"Que la personne qui est arrivée la dernière, celle qui demande, quelle sorte? Quelle sorte?"
the Frenchman said, without opening his eyes.
"Vous m'excuserez, mais vous voyez? Revenez vers 10 heures, encore mieux, demain."
"Quelle sorte?"
repeated the Frenchman impatiently.
"C'est moi, n'est-ce pas?"
and having received an answer in the affirmative, Oblonsky, forgetting the request he had wanted to make to Lydia Ivanovna, forgetting his sister's affairs, and with the one desire to get away from there as quickly as possible, went out on tiptoe and ran out into the street as from an infected house. After which he talked and joked for a long time with an izvozchik, trying to regain his senses as soon as possible. At the French Theatre, where he arrived in time for the last act, and afterwards at the Tatar restaurant, where he had some champagne, Oblonsky was able to some extent to breathe again in an atmosphere congenial to him, but nevertheless he was not at all himself that evening. When he returned to Pyotr Oblonsky's house where he was staying, he found a note from Betsy. She wrote that she greatly wished to finish the conversation they had begun and asked him to call next day. Scarcely had he finished reading the note and made a wry face over it, when he heard downstairs the heavy steps of men carrying something heavy. He went down to see what it was. It was Pyotr Oblonsky, grown young again. He was so drunk that he could not get up the stairs, but on seeing Oblonsky he ordered the men to put him on his feet, and clinging to Stepan he went with him to his room, began relating how he had spent the evening, and fell asleep there. Oblonsky was in low spirits, a thing that rarely happened to him, and could not fall asleep for a long time. Everything he recalled was nauseous, but most repulsive of all, like something shameful, was the memory of the evening at Lydia Ivanovna's. Next day he received from Karenin a definite refusal to divorce Anna, and understood that this decision was based on what the Frenchman had said the evening before in his real or pretended sleep. Chapter 23. Before any definite step can be taken in a household, there must be either complete division or loving accord between husband and wife. When their relations are indefinite, it is impossible for them to make any move. Many families continue for years in their old ruts, hated by both husband and wife, merely because there is neither complete discord nor harmony. Both for Vronsky and for Anna, life in Moscow in the heat and dust, when the sun no longer shone as in spring but burned as in summer, when all the trees on the boulevards had long been in leaf and the leaves were already covered with dust, was intolerable. Nevertheless, they did not move to Vozvizhenskoye, as they had long ago decided to do, but stayed in Moscow, which had become obnoxious to them both, because of late there had not been harmony between them. The irritation which divided them had no tangible cause, and all attempts at an explanation not only failed to clear it away, but increased it. It was an inner irritation, caused on her side by a diminution of his love for her, and on his by regret that for her sake he had placed himself in a distressing situation which she, instead of trying to alleviate, made still harder. Neither of them spoke of the cause of their irritation, but each thought the other in the wrong, and at every opportunity tried to prove that this was so. For her, he, with all his habits, thoughts, wishes, mental and physical faculties, the whole of his nature, consisted of one thing only— love for women, and this love she felt ought to be wholly concentrated on her alone. This love was diminishing, therefore, in her judgment, part of his love must have been transferred to other women, or to one other woman. She was jealous not of any one woman, but of the diminution of his love. Not having as yet an object for her jealousy, she sought one. At the slightest hint she transferred her jealousy from one object to another. Now she was jealous of the coarse women with whom, through his bachelor connections, he might so easily have intercourse, now of the society women whom he might meet, now of some imaginary girl whom he might marry after repudiating her. This last jealousy tormented her more than anything else, especially since, in an expansive moment, he had carelessly told her that his mother understood him so little that she had tried to persuade him to marry the young Princess Sorokina. And being jealous, Anna was indignant with him and constantly sought reasons to justify her indignation.
She blamed him for everything that was hard in her situation. The torture of expectation, living betwixt heaven and earth, which she endured there in Moscow, Karenin's dilatoriness and indecision, her loneliness, she attributed all to him. If he loved her, he would fully understand the difficulty of her situation and would deliver her from it. That they were living in Moscow instead of in the country was also his fault. He could not live buried in the country as she desired. He needed society, and so he had placed her in this terrible position, the misery of which he would not understand. And it was likewise his fault that she was forever parted from her son. Even the rare moments of tenderness which occurred between them did not pacify her. In his tenderness she now saw a tinge of calm assurance which had not been there before and irritated her. It was growing dusk. Anna, all alone, awaiting his return from a bachelor dinner party, paced up and down his study, which was the room in which the street noises were least audible, recalling in detail every word of their yesterday's quarrel. Passing ever backwards from the memorably offensive words of the quarrel to their cause, she at last got back to the beginning of their conversation. For a long time she could not believe that the dispute had begun from a perfectly inoffensive conversation about a matter that did not touch the hearts of either. Yet it was so. It had all begun by his laughing at high schools for girls, which he considered unnecessary, and she defended. He spoke disrespectfully of the education of women in general, and said that Hannah, her little English protégé, did not at all need to know physics. This provoked Anna. She saw in it a contemptuous allusion to her own knowledge, and she invented and uttered a phrase in retaliation which should revenge the pain he had caused her. "I don't expect you to understand me and my feelings as an affectionate man would, but I did expect ordinary delicacy," she said. And he really had flushed with vexation and had said something disagreeable. She did not remember her reply to it, but remembered that in answer he had said with obvious intent to hurt her, too, "I can take no interest in your partiality for that little girl, because I can see that it is unnatural." The cruelty with which she annihilated the world which she had so painfully constructed for herself to be able to endure her hard life, the injustice of his accusation that she was dissembling and unnatural, roused her indignation. "I am very sorry that only what is coarse and material is comprehensible and natural to you," she retorted, and left the room. When he came to her in the evening, they did not refer to the quarrel, but both felt that it was only smoothed over, not settled. Today he had been away from home all day, and she had felt so lonely, and it was so painful to feel herself at discord with him, that she wished to forget it all, to forgive and make it up with him. Wishing even to blame herself and to justify him, she said to herself, "I am to blame. I am irritable and unreasonably jealous. I will make it up with him, and we will go back to the country. There I shall be calmer." "Unnatural!" She suddenly remembered the word that had hurt her most, though it was not so much the word as his intention to pain her. "I know what he wanted to say. He wanted to say that it is unnatural not to love one's own daughter and yet to love another's child. What does he know of love for children? Of my love for Seretse, whom I have given up for his sake, and that desire to hurt me? No. He must be in love with some other woman. It can't be anything else." Then, realizing that in her attempt to quiet herself she had again completed the circle she had already gone round so often, and had returned to her former cause of irritation, she was horror-struck at herself. "Is it possible that I can't? Is it possible that I can't take it on myself?" she wondered, and began again from the beginning. "He is truthful. He is honest. He loves me, I love him. In a few days I shall get my divorce. What more do I need?" "I need calm and confidence.
and I will take the blame on myself. Yes. Now, as soon as he comes back, I will tell him I was to blame, though in fact I was not, and we will go away.
And not to continue thinking, and not to yield to irritation, she rang and ordered her trunks to be brought, to pack their things for the country. At 10 o'clock, Vronsky returned. Chapter 24.
Well, have you had a good time?
She asked, coming out to meet him with a meek and repentant look on her face.
Just as usual, he answered,
perceiving at a glance that she was in one of her pleasant moods. He was already accustomed to these transitions, and today was specially glad, because he himself was in the best of spirits.
What do I see? Ah, that's right, he said, pointing to the trunks in the anteroom.
Yes, we must go away. I went for a drive, and it was so lovely that I longed to be in the country. There isn't anything to keep you, is there?
Oh, it is my only wish. I'll come in a moment, and we'll have a talk. I will only go and change. Order tea.
And he went to his room.
There was something offensive in his saying, "Ah, that's right," as one speaks to a child when it stops being capricious. And still more offensive was the contrast between her guilty tone and his self-confident one. For a moment she felt a desire to fight, rising within her, but with an effort she mastered it and met him with her former cheerfulness. When he returned, she told him, partly repeating words she had prepared, how she had spent the day and her plans for the move to the country.
"Do you know, it came to me almost like an inspiration," said she. "Why must we wait here for the divorce? Won't it do just as well in the country? I can't wait any longer. I don't want to hope. I don't want to hear anything about the divorce. I have made up my mind that it shall not influence my life any more. Do you agree?"
"Oh, yes," he answered, looking uneasily at her excited face.
"Well, and what have you been doing? Who was there?" she asked after a pause.
Vronsky named the guests. "The dinner was capital. The boat races and everything quite nice. But in Moscow they can't get on without doing something ridiculous. Some sort of a lady turned up, the Queen of Sweden's swimming instructress, and displayed her art."
"What?
She swam?" asked Anna, with a frown.
"Yes, in some sort of red costume de natation. A hideous old creature."
"Well then, when are we to be off?"
"What an absurd fancy."
"And did she swim in some particular way?"
asked Anna, without answering his question.
"Well, nothing particular at all. I said it was awfully absurd."
"Well, when do you think of going?"
Anna shook her head, as though driving away an unpleasant thought.
"When are we going? Why, the sooner the better. We can't get ready by tomorrow, but the day after?"
"Yes. No, wait a bit. The day after tomorrow is Sunday, and I must go and see Maman," said Vronsky,
and became confused, because as soon as he had mentioned his mother, he felt an intent and suspicious gaze fixed upon him. His embarrassment confirmed her suspicions. She flushed and moved away from him. It was no longer the Queen of Sweden's instructress, but the Princess Sorokina, who lived in the country near Moscow with the Countess Vronskaya, who presented herself to Anna's imagination.
"You could go there tomorrow," she said.
"No, I tell you. The things about which I have to go, to fetch a power of attorney and some money, will not have arrived by tomorrow," he replied.
"If that's so, then we won't go at all."
"But why not?"
"I won't go any later, Monday or not at all."
"Why is that?"
said Vronsky, as if in surprise.
"Well, there's no sense in that."
"You see no sense in it because you don't care at all about me,"